Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us by phone is our first guest. He's Edward Barbier. He's the author of The Water Paradox, the new book, Why There Will Never Be Enough Water and How to Avoid the Coming Crisis. Ed, thanks so much for joining Nell and me this morning on This Green Earth to talk about your book.
Well, thanks, Chris, for having me.
Well, let's start here. There's a lot to talk about. And like we said in our intro, water is precious, particularly out here in the western U.S., and we'll get to that in a little bit. But let's start with this. What is the paradox associated with water?
Well, the paradox is that despite all the signs, scientific and policy signs, that water is getting increasingly scarce around the world, why are we not marshaling all our human ingenuity, innovations, and incentives to alleviate this crisis?
And so what does the crisis take, let's say, the form of?
Well, first of all, what we're seeing is that about a third of the world's population, about 2.5 billion people, are already living in areas of scarcity. And that number is going to rise. By 2050, we could see half of the world and possibly half of our grain production suffer from water stress. You add on to that all the predictions for climate change, which is going to affect water supplies drastically, and then growing demands, new demands for water for population growth, economic development, and urbanization. And you can see that the crisis is going to get worse rather than better unless we start to do something about it.
Yeah, you have an interesting table titled Projected Water Stress in Countries Start Around 2040. And some of these countries are not too small and quite important. They include places like, where you cite extreme water stress, countries like Afghanistan, Iran, Israel, Kazakhstan, Kuwait, Qatar, Saudi Arabia. These are places where you describe as under extreme water stress. Give us a definition of that term first.
Well, extreme water stress is where the increasing withdrawal of water is going to exceed the ability of water to regenerate renewed supplies. We have two sources of water: surface water, which comes from rivers and water bodies like lakes and ponds and reservoirs. And then we also have groundwater, which is the fossilized water underground. And when you add up the total water, freshwater supplies available to these countries, the projection for increased demand is really going to outstrip those supplies. And we're going to see two things. First of all, we're going to see increasing scarcity of the water, and that's going to mean that for these countries to obtain more supplies for their growing populations and economies, it's going to cost them more and more to do so. And then the other thing we're going to see is that many of the countries you read out are in extreme arid and semi-arid regions. Mm. We're going to see the effects of climate change start to really bite into the supplies. And you add that to the fact that these are very politically volatile mm-hmm. areas of the world, we also might start to see water figure into lots of conflicts and disputes between these countries, and that's not a good thing. So we're going to see both economic, political, and social consequences of water scarcity pretty soon.
So, you know, these lists are really interesting to look at because it's not just the developing countries or the super arid countries that are going to see water stress. The United States, where we are, of course, is in the medium to high water stress category. So what does that look like for us?
That's a great question. I mean, and that's extremely important, is that the western United States is predominantly arid and semi-arid as well. We have a similar problem coming that many states are facing, which is that the original use of water in the West and the United States, 80% of it was for agriculture, but the fastest growing demands are for urban, municipal, and industrial uses of water. Our populations and cities are growing rapidly in the West. We also are facing the consequences of climate change and increasing frequent and more prolonged droughts. So the United States is increasingly facing the same consequences, that water scarcity is a problem that's growing, and it's going to increase with all the competing demands for water. And then the third dimension is that many citizens of the West and the United States care about the environmental conditions of the water. There's, recreation is a growing industry, fishing, boating, and just simply enjoyment of rivers and lakes is incredibly important to many people. So there's increasing demand to leave the water in the ecosystems that is the rivers and streams. And then finally, the point I try to make in the book is that, unfortunately, our policies, our institutions, and our government structures were developed in a time when water was relatively abundant, and which there weren't many people, and there wasn't much urbanization, and agriculture was the principal use of water. We need to adapt those management regimes in order to deal with scarcity, and that's the challenge moving forward.
I thought it was really interesting that, like, you know, one of the points you seem to be making is that it's not necessarily that we need to panic because there isn't enough water. It's that we're just not managing it well, and we don't have the right policies and governance in place, right?
That's absolutely right, Neil. Or we could turn this around and say we can't do anything about climate change. We can't change the amount of water. But what we can do is manage the demand for it more, and to try to balance out these competing demands. And to do that, we do need to rethink and develop better institutions, governments, and incentives.
We're speaking with Edward Barbier. He's the professor of economics and senior scholar in the School of Global Environmental Sustainability at Colorado State University. He's also the author of the new book, The Water Paradox: Why There Will Never Be Enough Water and How to Avoid the Coming Crisis. And just to circle back or localize it, you know, we here in Park City and Summit County recognize how precious water is because it's literally foundational to our economics here, you know, mostly in the form of snow, because it drives our wintertime economy.
That's right.
No water in the form of snow, and our economy suffers as a result. And in the summer, not enough water in our reservoirs, per se, because we have very dry summers precipitation-wise, then we suffer, can suffer not only recreationally, but more importantly, agriculturally. So water is indeed precious out west, and there is more and more of us putting demands on our water infrastructure. And so let's circle back then. You talk about proper management of water and the proper pricing of water. Let's talk a little bit, expand on that a little bit.
Yes, pricing is key to all of this. What you want to see is, as any commodity, and water is not excluded, gets more and more scarce, then that means that we need to pay more for the use of it. The problem we're seeing right now is that there is growing demand for water from cities and urban areas, and that's reflected in people valuing the water more. Generally, water in cities and in growing industrial uses is about $250 per cubic per acre foot, whereas in agriculture use, because it's allocated to agriculture primarily, water is used abundantly, and it's about $25 per acre foot. Now, that means that there is an incentive here to save water and to use it better if we sell some of the water that's in agriculture to the growing uses for urban and industrial use. This would do two things. First of all, it would mean that people would conserve water more because they're paying more for it. And secondly, the farmers themselves would have an incentive to save water and use it more wisely, adopt a more water-saving irrigation and other means, because water is now more valuable to them. They're able to sell it for money to the cities. Why don't we see more of this? Well, that has a lot to do with the fact that drought makes farmers reluctant to sell their water. Many of the farmers themselves may not own the water. It actually belongs to the irrigation districts which were created by the large-scale water project. And that means that they're not allowed to sell it to non-agricultural users. If they don't sell it to another farmer, then that's the only trade they can do, is to other farmers. And then finally, it's really difficult to get water from one place to another, so we have to think carefully. If we're going to make lots of trades between farmers and cities, we have to think about the appropriate infrastructure. So water markets really work, and if they're allowed to develop, a lot of Western states are experimenting with them, and there's a lot of success that's starting to happen to take advantage of this difference in prices and to try to manage between the two uses.
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. So let's talk about some examples of those successes. Who would you point to and say they're running their water market, let's say, properly?
Okay. Well, one city that seems to be making some headway is Santa Fe in New Mexico. And then there's Arizona is also struggling with the same issue of managing water. And one of the things that both Arizona and Santa Fe are experimenting with is what's called water banks. And water banks are just like ordinary banks. Farmers put their excess water in this bank, and then they have the choice in the future either to withdraw the money from the pooled supply from all farmers for extra water for them in drought seasons, or alternatively, if there isn't a drought or there's excess water in the bank, it can be lent out to and temporary lease to urban and industrial users. So water banks work just like ordinary banks, just the currency is water rather than money. And that's proving successful because it takes the burden off the individual farmers' risk of drought and concerns about drought. And it also means there's more supplies of water pooled that can be delivered and sold to cities and urban areas. That's one side of the equation, is dealing with the supply of water, getting it from agriculture to growing uses. The other side of it is managing the water in cities itself. So what many cities are starting to think about in the West is what's called two-tier pricing for water and sanitation services. So what that means is that for an average small and low-income household, there would be one price of water. But if you exceed that price if you use more water than what a small household would use, then you'd pay a second higher price of water. And that would cause households and businesses to conserve on their water because
right.
they would try and keep within the conserving amounts.
Well, here in Park City, we have a very, I would call it progressive water tier system. We actually have six tiers
exactly.
or blocks. And I printed it out, the fee structure, and I'll just run through some of the numbers quickly. If priced on a per 1,000-gallon basis, from 0 to 5,000 gallons, that's block one that you use, you
that's
pay
right.
$6.12 per 1,000 gallons, roughly 6/10 of a cent per gallon. As you go up in your usage between 5 and 15,000 gallons, you pay $9.81 per 1,000 gallons, so 9/10 of a cent per gallon there. And so on and so forth, all the way up to block six for someone who actually needs 55,000 gallons of water a month or whatever, they'll pay roughly $28 per thousand or 2.8 cents per gallon for the water they use. This is for residential use, not commercial. Is that a pricing system that you see that is an example of pricing water in a proper way?
That's exactly right. Now, each city is going to have to decide what is the tier structure that works best for them.
Right.
But what the problem is with pricing of residential and commercial water in cities is that at the moment, across the United States, 50% of the operating costs of getting that water is paid for by the government, 50% by the customer. And then, meanwhile, the investment cost, the investment in actually building the reservoirs and the the pipelines and all that, all the infrastructure investment, 70% of that's paid by government. We cannot keep doing that without running into the problems of not paying enough for water scarcity. So whatever pricing scheme we come up with, and this two-tier scheme is will control use, we have to make sure that the prices themselves will help recover some of those costs, because we need to recover the cost of infrastructure and operation to reduce waste and use within the system as well. And then, of course, the other thing is that pricing does something else. It means that households will start turning off water when they don't need it. They'll start saving. We're seeing this in electricity, where we have off-peak and on-peak uses of electricity. We need to think about that with water. We also need to have programs that would encourage customers to use water-saving appliances. Again, the analogy with electricity and energy is that we have an Energy Star program where you can get rebates if you buy energy-efficient appliances. We should have the same thing for water, for showers, for toilets, for washing machines, and so forth.
So in addition to recovering, you know, those infrastructure costs that you mentioned in the pricing of water, you talk about recovering the cost of environmental damages. How do you do that? How do you even start, you know, calculating those costs and incorporating that into your water rates?
That's an excellent question now. One of the things I discuss in the book is about integrated river basin management, or at least a comprehensive river basin management. And that's where you look at not a body of water such as a river from the standpoint of which state owns which part of it, but from the standpoint of the entire river basin. How do you manage all the water for all the uses? And one of the things that comes out from successful river basin management from around the world is that environmental concerns are incredibly important to all of this. We have to figure out, in addition to figuring out how much we want to use for agriculture, municipal, and industrial use, we want to think about how much we need to leave in the river itself so that the river is healthy and will maintain good flows in both drought conditions and in other times. And also, what are the environmental uses we want to sustain on the river, whether it's for recreation, tourism, or simply maintaining a healthy river. So we have to think of the environment and in-stream water as one of the important uses, if you like, of a river. So river basin management needs to deal with all of these aspects. To do that, we have to think about what happens to the river if we don't take care of it. What are the damages? What are the values that we lose and the benefits, and who's affected? And then we also have to bring those entities, recreational groups, environmental groups, to the table, along with agriculture and urban users, to involve all the stakeholders in the discussion of how to manage the river in the long run.
Yeah, well, here in Utah, you're nodding now. You know what I'm going to say? Here in Utah, the river is the source, or is on the bottom of the list as far as who gets the water first.
That's right.
Fish are last. And
that's exactly right. And that's a legacy of Western law.
Yeah.
Is that, again, going back to, if you think back to, 19th century Western states, the primary concern was there was no people. How do we get people to settle here? Most of them coming out would be engaged in agriculture or ranching. So we gave the water to them first in line, first in time. Mm. So they got the water use first. And that's why we've ended up with 80% of our water allocated to agriculture and ranching. And then, of course, as cities started to grow, we started to think about how to send water to the cities. And now, in the late 20th century, early 21st century, we're now concerned about the environment. And so it's the last allocation. But all our laws are geared towards supporting what's called the consumptive uses of water, whereas in-stream flow, the environmental, the fishes, if you like, are the last consideration. That's starting to change, but we have to think about our laws and how our institutions and incentives are going to manage that use as well.
Are there any other countries that are doing this right, that have, you know, better protected in-stream flows or where their policies better reflect the importance of environmental water?
Well, one of the big experiments in Hope River Basin management is occurring in Australia on the Murray-Darling River, where for the last 30 years they decided to manage the entire river basin. And they found out five things. First of all, that a crisis is a good motivator. So they dealt with a huge drought and had to rethink their river basin management on the basis of a prolonged drought. Secondly, they decided that the river basin itself had to be the priority for jurisdiction over the individual states, and they set up institutions and government structures to think river basin-wide. Thirdly, they added in the environment as a factor. They recognized that if they didn't keep healthy flows in the river, in the rivers, then the farmers and urban areas would ultimately suffer as well. And so they started to think about, if we're going to leave water in the river, it has to be the first priority, not the last. And secondly, if we're going to manage the competing uses, we have to use water markets. And the water markets are not just between agriculture and urban, but also environmental groups and recreational groups can also buy water. If they don't think there's enough water for their activities, or they would like to preserve more of the environment, they can pay for water, and then equally the water can be sold between agriculture and urban uses, as we talked about before.
Right, and one area I've seen over the last 20 years or so where technology is playing an increasing role is the use of advanced treated water or wastewater to be introduced back into the community, either supplementing stream flows or used as irrigation. Where I came from in Florida and Southern California and Arizona, advanced treated wastewater is used to irrigate public green spaces and et cetera. Or in some cases, it's being reintroduced into the groundwater and then used as a source, raw source, for drinking water systems. So technology can play a role in that market also.
Absolutely. And technology is making a huge impact on groundwater, as you mentioned, Chris, that we have better technology to assess what water is underground and how much there is, and how quickly we're using it up before it gets recharged. And that's incredibly important. It's also, technology is also helping with the trade. We can now use technology and call up the market prices for water, but also use the technology to monitor and track how much water is being transferred, how much water is available to the farmers if they sell some of it or all of it. So technology is huge, and innovations in the future will be huge. What we want to see is water-saving innovations and innovations that help monitor and deliver the services. And to do that, we need the incentives and institutions to encourage those innovations.
Well, we have just a couple of minutes left, so I want to kind of ask about your take on this. Do you feel, when you look at the future of water management and water use, do you feel optimistic? Do you feel like this is heading in a positive direction yet?
I think there's encouraging signs. When I see the developments that have occurred in recent years. So, for example, in response to its drought, California implemented some wide-sweeping groundwater law changes, which are incredibly important. Up to then, groundwater was treated as a free-for-all, and now they have some more stringent uses. I see that river managers and those responsible rivers are starting to understand we have to think more comprehensively about the rivers. And I see that there is growing concern and interest in trying to change our institutions to grapple with scarcity. And I think that's encouraging. I think the signs that are discouraging is a problem that I talk about in the book called water grabbing, where you have very powerful companies. Some of them are international companies that are simply coming in to all parts of the world, including the West of the United States, and buying up access to water. buying out, making bids on farmland to large tracts of farmland to grow, to just basically access the water rights, and that's of concern to me because I think that it is one way of dealing with the crisis, but the short term gain is matched, more than matched, by the long term possibilities of conflicts and resentment, which I think is going to be a difficulty.
Right.
And this is, of course, occurring a lot more in poor countries are the targets of this water grabbing. And so we do need to think carefully about that.
Edward Barbier is professor of economics and a senior scholar in the School of Global Environmental Sustainability at Colorado State University. He's the author of the new book, The Water Paradox: Why There Will Never Be Enough Water and How to Avoid the Coming Crisis. Ed, do you have a plug for a website or so that you blog, or otherwise people can learn more about your work?
Yes, I have edward.barbier.com. People are welcome to come see my website.
Perfect. We will, and we'll stay in touch. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us this morning on the screen.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Neil.
All right.